Now, we weren't planning on this. Let's do the course one more time. If you were to just add your own extra beat in there, right? Your own extra clap, right? Because that's the thing. It's called syncopation. Thank you. Thanks. So if you were to just kind of add your own extra in there, as they do the chorus, you do it, and then we're going to try to follow you. Be seated. They're going to bring the table up. So good. Oh, we need help. People are like, speak for yourself. Okay, I need help. I need help. I wanted to do that illustration because, as we've already alluded to it tonight, one through just the worship wrap up and talking about worship in and of itself as being a rhythm in our life. But then also just practically just clapping and the different beats and how we do it and how that speaks to rhythm. We're doing that because tonight is part of our sermon series, right? Enter In. We're picking a different theme each week to explore different places that Jesus invites us to enter into, because he wants to use your life to spell Jesus to the world. He wants to use my life to spell Jesus to the world, right? Through our actions, through our attitudes, through the example that we give. And one of the ways that he does that is that he will at times come in and invite us to enter into new rhythms of life, right? He'll invite us to enter into new rhythms of life. There's all kinds of rhythms that are associated with life. And then for some of us, we're more comfortable with certain rhythms than others, right? It might be that for you, if you're not a music person like me and you're used to clapping one way, it's uncomfortable to clap another way. We were talking about this illustration during the week about how we were going to do it, how we were going to set it up, and how it was going to go, because we weren't sure. We've not done that before. And then we started talking about other things that might make you uncomfortable, like when you stand and clasp your hands. I'm a left index finger over the top.
You might be a right index finger over the top.
If I were to stand that way, right, it makes me feel uncomfortable because that's not what I'm used to. It might be that how you cross your feet when you sit down, that there are certain practices that are comfortable for you and then certain practices that are uncomfortable for you. One of the things that Jesus does when we make a vow of devotion to him is that he begins to change our rhythms. And what I want to talk tonight about is what some of those rhythms are, but I also want to affirm that it's okay for you to feel uncomfortable when the rhythm is changing. It's okay for it to feel new to you. It's okay for it to feel awkward to you. If you're not prepared for the feeling of awkwardness and discomfort, you might naturally associate those feelings with something that you should not do. When it's really just the sign of being something new that you've got to press through until it becomes familiar. Rhythms. Let's look at some verses together. Mark 1, 16 to 20. It's going to pop up on the screen. Nope, it's not going to be on the screen. I got it right here. Mark 1, 16 to 20. One day as Jesus was walking along the shore of the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and his brother Andrew throwing a net into the water. This is important, this clause, because they fished for a living. Their vocation was a rhythm, right? There was a certain rhythm to their life, what they did for work, and then what they did for work dictated when they got up and their routine throughout their day. Vocation gives you a life rhythm. Jesus called out to them, "Come and follow me, and I will show you how to fish for people." And they left their nets at once to follow him. Now, that's either because they hated their work, they're like, finally, somebody's giving me something else to do, or which I don't think that's the case, or it's because they believed something about Jesus. They left their nets at once and followed him. A little further up the shore, Jesus saw Zebedee's sons, James and John, in a boat repairing their nets. He called to them at once. They also followed him, leaving their father Zebedee in the boat. Right? He's like, hey, where are you guys going? We got work to do. Luke 5, 8 through 11 reads this way. When Simon Peter realized what had happened, he fell to his knees before Jesus and said, we've fast-forwarded through time. Oh, Lord, please leave me. I'm such a sinful man. For he was awestruck by the number of fish they had caught, right? This is the story where Jesus says, put your net on the other side of the boat. And he says, well, we've been fishing all night. You're a carpenter. I'm a fisherman. Try not to tell me what to do. Jesus says, do it anyway. So he does. And they catch so many fish, the boat's about to sink. His partners, James and John, the sons of Zebedee, were also amazed. And Jesus replied to Simon, don't be afraid. From now on, you will be fishing for people. And as soon as they landed, they left everything and followed Jesus. Now, for my Bible nerds, I included this one because the Lucan narrative is not a repeat of what Mark gives. I believe, as a lot of people do, that this is something that happened actually later in time, which means that early on when they left their work to follow Jesus, it was kind of an intermittent gig. They would travel with Jesus some, then they would go back to the work. They would travel with Jesus some, then they would go back to the work. And then when you get to Luke chapter 5, what you find is there's this final moment where Jesus calls them, you've got to leave everything altogether. You can't go back to it. You've got to leave that rhythm completely. I've got a new rhythm of life for you following me. Then we get to Luke 5, 27 to 32. It says, later as Jesus left town, moving through time, he saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at his tax collector's booth. Follow me and be my disciple, Jesus said to him. So Levi got up, left everything, and followed him. I'm going to stop there. Left everything and followed him. There are times when Jesus changes our rhythm and we don't even know it's coming. So let's do another participation. I'm not going to ask you to clap. When you see the words in these texts, left everything, when you see that, what do you think that included, right? Because it's this broad statement, left everything. What did it mean for them practically in reality? Anybody? Somebody over here. Habits. Family. Anybody? Friends, yes. Anybody back here? Anybody? Home, yes, home. Anybody in the middle? Anybody? Possessions, yeah, things, right? Things that they couldn't take everything they had with them, right? They left everything. Anybody here? Crystal? Say that again? Oh, old mindsets, yes. Right, because they saw themselves, right, as fishermen, right? Their identity, their self-perception, so good. Let's work it up the side. Anybody? Anybody? Marla? What do they have to leave? Left everything. Yeah, they wanted to be followers of God. So it was a new way of believing, a new way of living. That's good. Chuck? Normalcy. Yeah, everything that was familiar. So when it says they left everything, it literally means that they left everything behind in order to take up this call that Jesus had given to them. I was praying and studying for this message this week, and it reminded me that for Vanessa and I, when we got married in 1997, that in 1999, who was anybody a grown-up in 1999 like me? Do you remember Y2K? Anybody else, right? Young people have no idea, right? The fear that gripped the world, right? If you don't know what Y2K was, just to bring you up to speed, there was this belief that the internal clock of computers, We're not going to turn over with two being the first number in the order of the year, right? Meaning that since computers had been invented, it was always 19-something, right? And so at some point, somebody asked the question, is this going to work? Will the internal clocks of these computers actually roll over and keep going, right? So it was a real thing, right? It was worldwide. wide fear that computers would shut down, which means that the banking system would fail, which means that the power grid would fail. Military, right? If you think about everything that is dependent on a computer and an internal clock, right? All these prognosticators were saying that, right, the world is going to come to an end. There was a family in the church that we went to that actually sold everything that they had and moved to Costa Rica to live off the grid. We were like, that's a little extreme. Should we go with them? Right? Because you're like, you don't know what's going to happen. So you're buying canned goods and jugs of water and getting money out of the bank. Did anybody else do this other than me? No? Yeah? All right. Okay. You did not know, right? And then New Year's Eve came and went and nothing happened. I don't know if we were excited that nothing happened or if we were disappointed that nothing happened. Right, because we had been preparing for something to happen, right? And so, but it didn't, and we're okay. So in 1999, I got a offer for a job promotion that I had accepted, that was going to be a game changer. I was still in corporate America then, and it was going to be a game changer for us because Vanessa was going to be able to stop working. We were going to be able to start having a family. We had a dream and a vision of what our future was going to look like. Now, was ministry still part of our present? It was. We operated a private foundation that did the Sunday morning hot breakfast and public church service for the homeless in Richmond. So every Sunday morning, we had a team of people. It was multiple churches that worked together and operated out of the kitchen of the church that we went to. But lots of churches participated, and we would show up. And in the wintertime, we would feed over 200 people this huge hot breakfast. And then we would do a church service right there in Monroe Park, right in the heart of VCU, and preach and minister to the homeless. And we had been doing that for years. So ministry was still part of our life, but our vocation, right, they were two separate things. And we lived in the inner city right next to a housing project. And so we were invested in families there and kids. And so when this job opportunity came, it was a big deal for us because it was going to enable Vanessa to stay home. And then we were going to be able to invest even more in this ministry that we were part of and the church that we were attending. And then in that same year, we were in a church service at Mechanicsville Christian Center where we went. And they announced from the pulpit that they were going to hire a pastor of business administration. And I looked at Vanessa and said, I think I'm supposed to do that. I think I'm supposed to do that job, which would mean reneging on the promotion that I had accepted, which meant that she was not going to be able to stop work, which meant that maybe we were going to have to postpone starting a family, which meant that instead of having more money, we were going to have less money. Are you following what I'm saying? Sometimes the things that Jesus calls us into interrupts the rhythm that we're used to and sometimes asks us to lay down the vision and the dream that we might have for our future in exchange for the vision and the dream that he has for our future. And in those moments, we have to decide which one we're going to chase. In those moments, we're going to have to decide which one we're going to reach for. And who you believe Jesus to be at the end of the day will dictate your decision. What you believe about Jesus, who you believe he is to you, will determine your decision in that moment. These are some rhythms that all of us have in life. We have our vocation. Marriage is a rhythm for us. Who we marry represents a rhythm for us in this life. Family size and source, how many children you're going to have. Are your children all going to be birthed, or will you adopt, or will you do foster care? How are you going to grow your family represents a rhythm in your life. Geography represents a rhythm for you. Where you live. Think about all the places in the world that you can live, and then you choose one, or maybe for the military, one is chosen for you, but that geographic identity, that location represents a certain rhythm for each of us. Your standard of living represents a rhythm. Your relationships, your hobbies. I think so often we think of our relationship with Jesus having to do with him being our spiritual advisor and helping us to focus in on bad things we need to stop doing and maybe good things we should start doing. And I would agree that's an aspect of our relationship with Jesus. I would argue it's an important aspect of our relationship with Jesus. But have you ever thought of Jesus being the band leader of your life? Have you thought about Jesus being the one who wants to set the rhythms that you choose? Have you ever stopped to think about how Jesus wants to be the one who gives you some direction about these decisions and about these choices? I love that song that we sing, that song we sang tonight, You Are. I loved all the things that we sang in that song, You Are, because I believe that Jesus is all of those things for us. He's our protector and he's our provider. But will you add to that list tonight that he is your king? Will you add to that list tonight that he is the ultimate authority in your life? Meaning that he has something to say about the rhythms that you set and the rhythms that you establish and the rhythms that you choose. Somebody say Matthew and Revelation. See, because we are given a few different pictures of who Jesus is. When we read in the gospel, when we read in Matthew, and then also when we read in the gospel of Luke, we're given this beautiful picture of baby Jesus. The shepherds find him. He's wrapped in swaddling clothes, and he's in a manger, and baby Jesus is for you, for some, maybe all that he's ever been to you. He's so cute. I hold him. He makes me feel good about myself. He looks at me with just unconditional love and acceptance. And then sometimes I put him down when I go do what I want to do. And then I go pick him up again when I need to feel like he loves me and that I matter to him. And then everybody else is excited about baby Jesus, and we talk to him in our baby voice. Right? There's this part of Jesus that engenders in us feelings of affection, that engenders in us these feelings of love and unconditional acceptance, and we just want to hold him, and this feeling of him holding us, and it gives us incredible comfort. But that's not all that Jesus is. For some of you, you need to get a bigger picture of Jesus. How about Revelation Jesus? Right? Because this is not baby Jesus. In Revelation 1, verse 9, it says, "And I, John, am your brother and your partner in suffering and in God's kingdom and in the patient endurance to which Jesus calls us. It says, I was exiled on the island of Patmos for preaching the word of God and for my testimony about Jesus. It was the Lord's day, and I was worshiping in the Spirit, and suddenly," come on, this weekend's going to be a suddenly for some of you, "suddenly I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet blast." Oh, you're not ready for this. Oh, come on. If somebody's asleep in here right now, they're not going to be for very long. I haven't attached this in a while, so I don't know if it's going to... Oh, yeah. If you've got little ones in here... The anticipation, right? It's lovely, isn't it? You're like, is he going to do it? Is he not going to do it? "Suddenly I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet blast." Yeah. Somebody's like, what just happened? Is it the rapture? I'm still here. Right? Fear. Yeah. Sometimes baby Jesus is important. But baby Jesus is not Jesus in our lives very often. The Jesus that's here is the Jesus that most of us need on most days. We need suddenly Jesus. We need Jesus with a voice that sounds like a trumpet blast. We need Jesus that gets our attention. We need Jesus that makes us tremble a little bit. We need Jesus to be this presence in our lives that causes us to say yes to whatever he asks of us. Listen to what John says. It says, suddenly I heard behind me a loud voice like a trumpet blast. And it said, write in a book everything you see and send it to the seven churches in the cities of Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and Laodicea. And when I turned to see who was speaking, I saw seven gold lampstands. And standing in the middle of the lampstands was someone like the Son of Man, Jesus. He was wearing a long robe with a gold sash across his chest. His head and his hair were white like wool and as white as snow. And his eyes were like flames of fire. This is not baby Jesus. His feet were like polished bronze refined in a furnace, and his voice thundered like mighty oceans. We know what that sounds like because we live close to the ocean. The thundering roar of waves breaking over and over and over again. It's loud. It's intimidating. It's attention-getting. It's thunderous. It's awe-inspiring. This is not baby Jesus. He held seven stars in his right hand, and a sharp two-edged sword came out of his mouth. Mouth. This is not baby Jesus. And his face was like the sun in all its brilliance. And when I saw him, I fell at his feet as if I were dead. I think a lot of us need to become more accustomed to this Jesus, this presence of Jesus in our lives that is authoritative, that is directive, that is, yes, at times demanding. Does he stop being baby Jesus for us altogether? Absolutely not. He's all of those things for us, but he can't be just this thing for us. He can't just be manger Jesus wrapped in swaddling clothes. Sometimes we need his eyes ablaze with fire and a sword coming out of his mouth to redirect us, to give us a new path, a new direction. What you ultimately believe about Jesus determines how far you will follow him and how much deference you will give to him. It's easy to say no to baby Jesus. It's hard to say no to Jesus that looks like flames might come out of his eyes and consume you. And if by some chance you sidestep that, then he's going to lop your head off with the sword that comes out of his mouth. You with me? He's hard to say no to. That part of Jesus is hard to not to follow. And he presents himself to us here in the Bible in this way to remind us who he is and that he is the ultimate authority in the universe because God has given him that authority. And so when I make a vow of devotion to him, what I'm saying to him is, I want you to direct my life. I want you to speak into my decisions. I want the life that you have for me and not make all the decisions about the life that I want myself to have and just hope that you'll bless it. He has something to say. He wants to speak into our choices. Sometimes he wants to change our rhythm. Sometimes he wants to reset our rhythm. Sometimes he asks us to walk down a different path. I think we're going to end up with two parts here tonight. So I want to keep going in this part here about Matthew and Revelation, about baby Jesus, right? And then scary Jesus. Can we call him scary Jesus? When we look at the disciples, it's remarkable that they just immediately left everything that they had. Now, but there was a reason for that. And the reason is because who they believed him to be. And who they believed him to be caused the kind of obedience to come out of them in the moment when the call came. Because all of these young men, we find them in some type of trade. And in the first century, in Jesus' day, if you were working in a trade, it meant that you had failed out of rabbi school. Every little boy, initially, we try to talk about this every couple of years, right, at church because of how striking it is that every little boy at some point goes to a rabbinical school of training. They're not given a choice. It's not an option. All of them go. Every single one of them. And the hope is that as a parent is that your child is going to excel. And if they don't excel, then they leave and they go back and learn the trade of their father. So the fact that Peter and Andrew were fishing, the fact that James and John were fishing is an indication that at some point a rabbi had said to them, you don't have what it takes. You've got to go learn your father's trade. At the age of six, they would enter into what's called Beit Sefer, which is the first phase of rabbinical training. And they would go to their local synagogue, and that local synagogue had a rabbi, and then that rabbi had some younger rabbis who were understudies, and they were responsible for the early education and training of all of these young boys. At 6 years old, they would stay in this school until they were 10. 6 to 10. All my math people, 4 years. And during those 4 years, you know what they would do? They memorize Genesis to Deuteronomy. What? Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. You're like, I'm 50 years old. I can't even say those books of the Bible. From 6 to 10, in 4 years, they were tasked with memorizing all of those books. If they couldn't do it, guess where they ended up? Back at home with dad, learning a trade until the age of 10. If they made it, if they could memorize Genesis to Deuteronomy, then they would go on to the next level of training, which was Beit Talmud. And at the age of 10, only those with promise were allowed to move forward to the next level. Only those, which means that now they're getting into the interpretation of the Mosaic Law, the application of the Mosaic Law, that they were having to make decisions and judgments about theological questions at 10 years old. Come on. There were no Veggie Tales. There were no flannel stories. There were not books with colored pictures and pop-ups. At the age of 10, only those with the most promise. And they would memorize all of the rest of the Old Testament. Shut up! No, it's true. 39 books of the Old Testament. From Genesis to Malachi. Memorize chapter and verse verbatim. I don't know about you. I'm just saying, if you can do that, you get to be whatever you want. But that wasn't the case. That was just to weed out the rest. At age 14, they would pass on to Beit Midrash, and they would apply to be a disciple of the rabbi that was instructing them, and they would begin to learn how to live a rabbinical lifestyle. They would begin to learn how to teach and how to lead a synagogue. And they had to be willing to abandon everything in order to take this step. And the question that the rabbi would ask, right, is you're going to be familiar with this term in a minute, is can this kid spread my yoke? Because a rabbi's interpretation of the law was called their yoke. So when Jesus says, my yoke is easy and my burden is light, that meant something to them, right? It meant that I'm going to help you understand the truth of God's word in ways that no one ever has before. And then if, by some chance, these kids, they had what it would take, even some of these kids, even at this point, would not make it all the way. You with me? They had not crossed the finish line yet. Even still, there was a final selection process. And if the rabbi was going to take them under his wing, and he was going to become a part of his cohort, you know the phrase that he would use? He would say, come and follow me. That was the phrase. If you are a Jewish young man and you're in a fishing boat, you heard someone say to you, you don't have what it takes. Go learn your father's trade. And then a rabbi comes to you and says those words, come and follow me. You better believe they left everything behind. Because in their culture and in their time, that meant a spiritual leader saw something in them that made them special, saw something in them that God had set them apart, chosen them. No one ever got a second chance, but these did. So when we see them lay it all down, but now we understand for them what it meant, what it could be. Of course they left everything behind. Why? Because of who they believed Jesus to be, that he was a rabbi who was now inviting them in to become something unique and someone special. What you believe about Jesus determines how quickly your heart is going to be willing to be obedient to him. Can I just say to you that you have some belief that you carry right now about who Jesus is? You do. You have some measure of belief, some measure of acceptance about who you understand Jesus to be. And just like they had cultural norms that motivated them to say yes to Jesus, what I would argue is that our cultural norms are actually moving in the opposite direction. Our cultural norms, that for them it was, of course, I'm going to submit myself to this person. I think for you and I that we've been immersed in cultural norms that say just the opposite. I think this idea of fully submitting ourselves to Christ in every way and every sense is actually moving against the grain of societal norms. And I would argue at times it's actually swimming upstream within the culture of some churches. But you know what Jesus is still in the business of doing? Of showing up in people's lives like he has showed up in mine and like he shows up in yours. And he's still in the business of saying to people, will you come and follow me? He's still in the business of saying to you, to me, because you're chosen, because you're special, because God has a plan for your life, because you're not here by accident, because God has plans and purposes that he wants to unleash and release you into. And part of that is going to be you being willing to maybe change some of the rhythms of your life that Jesus wants to change and alter so that he can set you onto the path and the destiny that he's called you to. I'm going to invite the worship team to come back up. Next week, we're going to dig more into the idea of resistance, the resistance we face. When we begin to enter into that space of letting Jesus change our rhythms. But I want to reread Luke 5:11 to you. Luke 5:11, is that on the, do I have that verse up there? Yep. And as soon as they landed, they left everything and followed Jesus. Everything. They were willing to leave it all. I think it's a rarity that Jesus asks us to leave everything behind. I do. Does he ask some people? I think he does. I think there are people that are on the mission field. I think there may be people that are immersed in certain paths and certain ways of life that need to be completely upended. So I think for most people, the all and everything is the exception. But can I just say to you that carrying in your heart a willingness to hold it all in front of him is still matters. It still matters. It means that there's something inside of me that says, Jesus, I want you to be involved in my choices. I want you to be, if I'm going to give myself to certain rhythms in life, right, then I want you to be a part of it. And can I just tell you that even when you do that, sometimes he comes and changes it. Because when Vanessa and I, right back there in 1999, can I just tell you, we had been praying about where we were going to live once we got married. We had been praying about where we were going to work. I already was, my job was established, but am I supposed to stay in this, right? There was this private foundation, this nonprofit that we were operating in. And so this idea of staying in corporate America, that was a prayerful decision. And we had this sense of permission from God. Just because God gives me a permission to establish a rhythm does not mean that Jesus isn't going to one day show up and change it. I think sometimes he starts us in one rhythm here to move us into that rhythm there. Sometimes this one serves that one, but sometimes it's just to get us used to us saying yes to him. Sometimes he points us in one direction because he wants us to feel what it's like to change direction. I think for me, for that season, it was both. I think Jesus gave me a 10 years of corporate America to learn the inner workings of organizational development. And then that was the gift that I was supposed to bring to vocational ministry for me when I crossed over, that he was making me ready in an unconventional way for the work that he had for me. So sometimes the one serves the other, even when it's about getting our heart ready for yielding to him. Stand with me. Are you willing to let Jesus set your rhythms in life? Will you include him when you have big decisions to make about who you're going to marry and where you're going to live and the vocation that you're going to chase after? Would you stop and consider the possibility that not baby Jesus, but eyes on fire, sword in his mouth Jesus, has something that he wants to say to you, to give you direction, to lead you in the path that he has for you, to set your rhythm, to determine your pace. Jesus. Father, I pray that as we step into this moment of worship that we're going to share together, not only as we've already talked about, is it going to be this another opportunity for feelings of love and affection and devotion to well up in our heart for you. But for some of us in this moment, that our vision of Jesus is going to grow up a little bit. It's going to mature. That we're going to move out of Matthew and Luke and make room for Jesus, who you are in Revelation. For you to be our King, not just our Savior, not just our Shepherd, not just our Provider and our Protector and our Comforter, but for you to be our King. For your authority to be the final authority in our lives. For us to live our lives in such a way that we carry a desire and a need for your permission. That in the decisions that we make, especially the big ones, especially the ones that set our rhythms in life, that we would want to hear what you have to say to us. In Jesus' name, let's worship together. There's going to be some people down here at the front to pray with you if you want prayer. Even if what you want prayer for doesn't have anything to do with what we've talked about tonight, that's okay. You come.